Welcome to Pharmacy Pathways. Today's guest has a career journey where, if we just put a bullet list of the things she's done so far on the screen, you would be able to determine for yourself that she has a story to tell. And while she was telling her story, it was so clear to me that she'll be perfect for this podcast because she just exemplifies everything that Pharmacy Pathways stands for, where we're looking to make big decisions. We want to be bold and resilient, and we also want to be curious about what's there for us, and we want to say yes to change or be open to change. And she's unique in the sense that she started in industry, but she wasn't a pharmacist at the time. Her experience in industry is actually what inspired her to go to pharmacy school. And so she sits here with us today as a pain management clinical pharmacist who also specializes in addiction medicine. So without further ado, I introduce to you Dr. Jasmine Ebron.
Hi guys. Hi Dominique.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm great.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being here. I'm really excited for what you have to share with us and the audience. I would love for you to give us a brief introduction as to who you are, a little bit about yourself before we get into your story.
Okay. My name is Dr. Jasmine Ebron. I am a pain management clinical pharmacist with a subspecialty in addiction medicine. I work for a integrative health company in the Maryland area. I have been a pharmacist for 8 years now. Pharmacy is actually my second career. So I had a previous career doing something else, and then decided to, after working in that career for 9 years, go to pharmacy school and become a pharmacist.
9 years and then deciding that I don't want to do this anymore exactly. Like, what's next for me? What inspired you to pivot? And can we talk a little bit about what you did in the industry setting and how that exposed you to seeing pharmacy?
I graduated from undergrad with a degree in biology, and I, right out of undergrad, started with a pharmaceutical company at the age of 21, and actually really enjoy that job. I enjoyed sales. I worked for Bristol Myers Squibb for 2 years as a territory sales rep, and then I switched to Sanofi Aventis and worked my way up through different sales positions. I was an institutional sales rep for Sanofi Aventis before pivoting. And I actually had a really fun time doing that job. The reason for the pivot, it's actually an interesting story. I got to a place in my career where I felt like this was not my passion, although it was a very fun job, a very lucrative career. I felt like I was in the managerial track, so it was going very well. But it felt like this was not my passion or where I needed to be. And I remember very distinctly my father sitting me down and challenging me on that. And actually motivating me to consider going back to grad school. So I think, so if there was a moment where I thought, am I gonna uproot my whole life and make a big change, it probably was my father's push to consider whether this was gonna be the career path that I continued with.
So you mentioned that it was very lucrative for you, right? And so deciding to not get paid anymore and to go back into school and to pay, a substantial amount of money, especially for pharmacy school. Like, what were the things you were, was it an easy yes for you, or was it like, I don't know, let me think on it? And did you have to really consider everything it would cost along the way?
At that time in my life, I owned my own home. I still had a really nice company car. And the career was going well. And so the decision was I going to give all of that up and then go to grad school and then go back to becoming a broke college student? And I decided that the answer to that was yes. So I sold my house. I gave back my car. And then I eventually moved into a studio apartment in Baltimore and downgraded my entire life.
Oh my goodness.
Now, I need you to appreciate a few things here. So because I had been out of undergrad for 9 years, that meant that things like physics one, which was what I needed for my biology degree, I took that course 9 years prior to then doing some of the prereqs to get into pharmacy school. So then I had to take physics two 9 years later. And then I redid my anatomy and physiology, one and two with lab to,
bless your heart.
So that could be fresh. So I can go into pharmacy school with that knowledge, more familiar to me. That was a real challenge. I think, you know, those things were in that moment a test of how much do you really want this?
Yeah.
Because there were quite a few obstacles, and it would have been much easier to continue with my first career that was going well. So that was a challenge for sure.
That is so admirable, because most people, when they're not happy doing something and they look at all the barriers that are in between unhappy and happy, they opt out of it.
Yeah.
And especially a big reason will be, well, that's going to take me 4 years. That's going to take me
at least
5 years.
Yeah.
But they don't realize, or they're not thinking, that 5 years is going to pass regardless.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
Where do you want to be in 5 years? Still here?
Yeah.
Or chasing your passions? And so that's just so admirable. I love that.
Thank you.
Because the audience for the podcast is also people who have been in the same place that you were, not feeling fulfilled with what they're doing, and deciding that they want to make a change. Or I know a little bit of it, but if you can tell us exactly what came after the big yes. So you say yes, you make these changes, you go into grad school. What was your journey like after that?
You know what? I want to add in a little piece there, because so I said yes, and then I had to tell my village that I was going to uproot my whole life and make this big pivot.
Yeah.
And so I sat my mother and my father down. I brought with them the materials that I had acquired from the pharmacy school that I had decided I was getting into. Now, I need you to know that at this point, I had not applied. I just had in my mind decided this is where I was going to pharmacy school.
Yeah.
I had gone to maybe one open house, and then fell in love. And we should just throw this out here now for the audience, because I'm a proud University of Maryland School of Pharmacy alum. And so I went to the open house. I met some of the faculty. I toured the pharmacy hall. And then in my mind, I decided this is where I was going to school. And I took back a lot of the paperwork about the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And then I sat my parents down and I told them, guys, we're going to be making a change. And I want you to be supportive. And they were super supportive, very impressed.
Aww.
So that part of the village was on board right away.
Yeah.
And then I went back to my sister, and she's going to love this when she sees this later. So, my little sister is a pharmacist, my little sister, who's an adult, is a pharmacist as well.
Yeah.
And at that time she was a PGY2.
Oh,
and so most people who are in the profession know that your second year of pharmacy school typically is when you're hard. Is that how it was for you?
Mine was hard every year.
Okay. So all 4 years. Yes.
Yes.
So and so she was going through the pharmacology portion, and it was
that's
hard, tough. Hard year for her. And so I remember going to her and telling her that I was going to leave the industry, pharmaceutical industry, and then I was going to go to grad school. And it was like we had this conversation yesterday. She goes, why? I mean,
like you don't want this life.
you see how hard this is, right? And I'm seeing you and the money you're making and how comfortable your life is. Why would you want to take this on? And so we still laugh about this.
Yeah.
So initially she was questioning whether me changing my entire life and then, you know, going to grad school and not having my Fridays and my Saturdays to do whatever I want, but to instead be studying in the library in that time.
Yeah.
Is that really the life that I wanted for myself? And people who were in the industry also, you know, they were like, we're making some good money. We're getting bonus checks. We're, this is where people want to be. This is
right.
where you are. So then I had to apply to pharmacy mm-hmm. school, because keep in mind, I had not gotten into anyone's pharmacy school before I had told the village, this is the plan. And so I remember studying for the PCAT while I was still working, because I had to, I was hopeful at least to get that those scores back mm-hmm. to have a bit more confidence of whether
before
I was
going. Before you put in that 2 week notice. Okay.
So that's what happened.
Yeah.
And so that was part of things that I had to kind of make sure were mm-hmm. aligned before I made the big transition.
I also studied for the PCAT while I was in a fellowship, a post-bac bachelorette okay. program, and I was in a lab. I was a lab assistant, and I would run my experiment and then go study and like take
right.
a nap
yeah.
and then wake
yeah.
up and then check on the experiment
right.
and come. It was a lot. It's
yeah.
very taxing.
Yes.
And then you have to retrain your brain to be a student again.
Yes. Just sit. For hours.
That's hard.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine, because I went back for my BCPS a year and a half after being out of school,
mm-hmm.
and I felt like a huge difference. It
mm-hmm.
was very hard to discipline myself again.
Mm-hmm.
That we're studying now,
right
after work,
yes,
and on the weekends. It was
mm-hmm.
it was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine 9 years out of that life.
9 year gap between undergrad and grad school. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. you really wanted this. Resiliency.
Yeah, that was,
oh
yes. So that was probably the first hurdle. The first hurdle.
Did y'all catch that? The first?
Right.
Okay, what was the next hurdle?
Having to recognize that I no longer had a job, and so I could not move as freely as I used to. This again, my dad. So it was my first semester. I was a P1, probably around like mid-year, so maybe like around the holidays.
Okay.
And my father called me and said, you know, Jasmine, you don't have a job anymore. And you're still moving and spending money, like you're making money.
That's hilarious.
You're going to blow through your savings if you continue this all 4 years. You might want to acknowledge that you don't have a job. And so,
oh wow,
please, you know, modify.
Assess the situation.
Yeah, like, do you need these things? I don't
yeah.
think you, these
that's,
are my needs, right? So that was probably like really pivoting. And some of my close
yeah.
friends who went to pharmacy school might challenge whether I took that conversation seriously enough.
Yes.
But there was a pivot. There was a pivot. Yeah.
Okay. Your dad sounds like a wise man. He sounds like a very wise man.
You know, you're not going to get me to agree to that on camera,
okay.
because he
okay.
might see this too. And so
she knows it. She's just not saying it out loud, but she knows.
No. Yes. Very, very wise man. Yeah, so you know, he is going to put the mirror up, and there's going to be some challenges. He will challenge you and then pull you forward.
Mm.
So that I can say with confidence, yeah.
Mm. So we can see where you get these traits.
Yeah.
I can hear them, how they're coming in from your family.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That is the support from them and everyone else in the village is, you know, the reason why making the shift happened, and then I was able to continue every year from pharmacy school, continuing
yeah.
to make that decision at that point. And then, to be clear, because I had given up so much, there wasn't a fallback plan at that point. I had given up a very lucrative career that was successful. So being so pharmacy school working out and then getting through pharmacy school in a way that I felt like was successful
mm-hmm.
was very important to me.
And you made it.
Yeah.
You made it to the other side.
But yes. Yeah.
And then you decided to go through more torture.
And
do a residency.
Right,
So,
yes, yeah.
what made you wanted to do a
Right.
residency?
So when I decided to go to pharmacy school, initially I thought I was going to get my PharmD, and then I was going to go and go back to the industry and become an MSL. And so MSL is a medical sales liaison. So that was the initial thought. And then when I got into pharmacy school, I had these amazing women trailblazers to learn from. In pharmacy school at University of Maryland, they have a few different tracks. And so I was in the geriatric and palliative care pathway. I got to learn from, I, and I'm gonna call, I'm gonna call them out, three amazing women. And so Dr. Chanel Whitaker was one of my, I call them I Heart teachers. Dr. Nicole Brandt was also another I Heart teacher. And then anyone who knows about palliative care and in the state of Maryland knows Dr. Lynn McPherson. And so and within my training, I had trailblazers and mentors who were super passionate about what they did and took it very personally. And they took a lot of interest in their students. So after working with them, after being on rotation with them, I developed a love for ambulatory care. And knew that if I wanted to, after pharmacy school, work in a ambulatory care setting, I was going to have to get some additional training. And so then I signed up for more training and more torture.
More training and more torture.
Right.
And then you did primary care out of residency for a
I
little
did.
while.
I did. So after residency, I actually worked in a clinic as a primary care clinical pharmacist. My first love was diabetes, so I primarily ran a diabetes clinic. I absolutely loved that. I loved being one of the people on the team that helped manage a chronic disease state. I loved making the connection with the patients. I loved doing the work that made them understand that I cared about them as a patient, and I got their buy-in in terms of a care plan that I would create. So that I absolutely loved. That I did for about 5 years. I find that a lot of the things that I learned from my industry experience, I get to continue to build upon. So relationship building, as someone who was in
You have to
sales.
be a people person.
Yeah, it's a big deal, right? So people buy, this is what we would say. So people buy from people they like, or there's something about you that they like that allows them to continue interacting with you, and then they might buy from you. And so developing relationships is a big deal in sales. And I find that developing relationships is a big deal in ambulatory care. So
Absolutely.
that was a thread for me that I think helped me in the ambulatory care space.
That was good. That
Thank you.
was real good how she tied that together. So how did you get exposed to pain medicine since you were focusing on diabetes so much in the clinic setting?
Yeah. You know what? Opportunity came and I was prepared for the opportunity and expressed an interest. So I mentioned that in pharmacy school, I did a geriatric and palliative care pathway. And I was exposed to particular rotations within that pathway. 5 years into being a primary care clinical pharmacist, where I focus on diabetes, there was an opening in my company for pain management. And I expressed interest, and they allowed me to train up in that position. So I did, when I transitioned to become a pain management clinical pharmacist, it required quite a bit of training that I was allowed to do kind of on the job and then also in my own studies. So thankfully, the way that pharmacy is set up is with all these continuing education courses, it is not challenging to, if you want to put the time in to continue to train up in different courses and areas. And that's part of what I did. The ASHP has a pain management certificate, and so many other companies have very formal ways to refresh your knowledge and education. I mentioned Lynn McPherson. People who do pain and palliative care know that she's published two different books about opioid rotations. So, you know, people who are in the field know that there are core things that you have to have readily available to be considered a serious practitioner and be a specialist in your profession. So I learned from various people who were already considered to be specialists in the profession. And so that was my journey into pain management specialty.
And then you also, well, can I tell them?
Yeah.
What happened yesterday?
Oh, sure. Yes, yes.
Yesterday was her last day of her fellowship program.
Yes. Yeah. I'm super, super proud of this last year. You talked about continuing to sign up for more training and more. We said suffering and
suffering. Torture.
Torture. This is a trend. This right here is a trend in my life. So I had been a pain management clinical pharmacist for a little bit more than a year. And there was something that I kept coming back to. There was a gap that I felt like needed to be fulfilled. Oftentimes when I would care for patients who had pain, too many of those patients would come into the clinic with long-term opioid use. And sometimes it was appropriate depending on the disease state. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be appropriate in a cancer patient or a sickle cell patient. Oftentimes what I've found is that we have left a patient on opioids at high doses for way too long. And now their body is severely dependent on that opioid. Mm-hmm. And what we appreciate about opioids is that the brain being exposed to opioids for a really long period of time is not really helping the patient's pain. If anything, it's making the body's pain, or it's making the body more sensitive to pain.
Yeah.
And the body is actually developing a tolerance to the opioid, so the opioids aren't working as well. So patients would come in, some of the patients would have real pain, severe pain, without a question. But I was seeing that some of my patients also were, some of them actually were either suffering from very complex, persistent opioid dependence, or some of them also had concurring opioid use disorder. And there was not a good place within my system where I work, and I think in a lot of healthcare systems, to treat a patient who has both pain and opioid use disorder. I had the opportunity to one of the physicians that I work with, he is board certified in pain management and in addiction medicine. And he asked me, I expressed my concern for this gap that I saw, that we don't have enough practitioners who are comfortable treating patients in what I call the gray.
Yeah.
So the gray is an overlap between they have real pain, but they might be suffering from a little bit of addiction as well. And we need more providers who are comfortable treating patients in this space. And so then he asked me if I wanted to be his fellow. And I said, let's see if my company will allow me to do that. So we created a fellowship program within my company that gave me the ability to train up in addiction medicine as my subspecialty within the pain management department, so that I could be one of the providers that had more of a comfort level with patients who lived in the gray. So consider a patient who might have had a history of heroin use or maybe OD'd at some point, and then later went on to develop metastatic cancer. Like, that patient might have a hard time finding someone who's comfortable treating his pain. Or a patient who's been on opioids for a really long time, 10, 15 years, really high doses of opioids. The pain generator, or what's causing the pain, really doesn't warrant chronic opioid use anymore, but their body is so used to being on opioids that coming off of it will literally be painful for that patient. Their body now craves it. And they still have pain that hasn't gone away, right? And so that patient also is particularly difficult to treat because they start to present like a patient who also, even if they don't actually meet the diagnosis for opioid use disorder, they might present like a patient who does, where they might be overutilizing their opioids. They might have lost control with how to take it. They might not be taking it the way it was prescribed. Yeah. And so that patient also is a patient who might be more complex to treat. And now that's a patient who we specialize in at my clinic.
That's amazing. I wanted to pause briefly before we like go into your role.
Okay.
And because when we think about fellowships, we normally associate them with more gearing you for industry setting.
Yeah.
So for those who are like, oh, I didn't know like fellowships could be clinical.
Yeah.
Why would one do a clinical fellowship versus a clinical residency?
Yeah, that's a good question. And also when you think about some of the traditional residency programs, you'll think about like a PGY one or a postgraduate year one, typically more general, and then going on to maybe a PGY two, more of a specialized in certain departments. And those are really structured programs where they have to be accredited. And because of that, then there are very specific courses and projects that have to be attached to that. A fellowship is maybe a little different in the sense that the organization that is that either has created or is offering this opportunity, they kind of decide what is their organizational need, and they have a bit more flexibility of what that curriculum is going to look like. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe a difference in the way that fellowships play out. Also, you'll see that from a fellowship standpoint, you'll hear fellows talk about doing capstone projects, where for residency, you'll hear them talk about their research project per se. So that's kind of a different. But I don't know that there's a lot of opportunities to do a clinical fellowship per se, because most of the ones that we've heard about are more industry focused. So we've kind of created a opportunity within my company to allow for more people to be trained in this really unique niche. So that was, and then it allowed me to continue to work my current job.
and then
take on that fellowship as well. So that was where me going back and doing a residency would have been me stopping my job, and then having to fully commit to, I guess, maybe another year of residency if that's what I chose to do.
And your current role now is you're a pain management clinical pharmacist.
Yes. And then I say that I have now a subspecialty in addiction medicine. That's how I phrase it. Yeah.
And so can you explain what your day-to-day or week-to-week looks like in your role? What are who are the, you mentioned some of the patients that you're interfacing with, but is it multidisciplinary? Give us a little picture of what your world looks like in this role.
Okay. So I work on two interdisciplinary teams in two different medical buildings. One, I work with an interdisciplinary team that has myself as a clinical pharmacist. On that particular team, though, the physician is pain and palliative care focused. So in that clinic, I don't do any addiction medicine. I follow the cases that we get that are brought into the clinic based on the physician that works there. Okay. And we also do more complex palliative care cases because of that. Nice. So that's kind of a way in which my week is from day to day kind of different. I work with a pain psychologist, which is a amazing tool or resource to have on the pain team. And I'll just pause and say, partly because it's very difficult to get good pain management if we're also not addressing some of the
psychological.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're a patient who has depression or anxiety, we can't ignore that and I think we're going to get good control of the pain. So having within the team, someone who's so knowledgeable is such a rare and like really needed addition to the team.
That should almost be a requirement.
I know, right? It should be. Okay. But there's not that many of them. And so I have that on one of my teams. And then on the second team, I work with a different medical building. That's actually where I do more of my overlap with pain and addiction. So I have a couple of days that are just my clinic days where I'll go in, I'll actually see patients in person with the team. As the clinical pharmacist, I have the opportunity to do things like medication histories. A lot of education about the appropriateness of whatever their pain regimen is, or maybe inappropriateness of whatever that is. We discuss what medications have already been used for pain. So we could talk about maybe what might be a more appropriate medication to use for their pain that might not be an opioid. And then continuing to follow up. So once we put a patient on a medication, there has to be monitoring of labs and also how effective it is, if they're having any safety concerns or any side effects that I would want to be aware of. And then I make medication recommendations back to the provider about how to change their pain regimen. Specifically in my pain pain clinic, that also we do a little addiction medicine, we will identify patients who live in the gray. And so if it's a patient who needs to be treated really concurrently for both, then I consider what their current pain plan is. And if we need to, then that's where I would have the opportunity to start a medication like Suboxone. So if we, and then we'll start it in the clinic for certain patients if it's appropriate. And then we also will monitor them over several months and then keep them because it's likely necessary to keep them on Suboxone for maybe 9 months to a year. So then the work I get to do in that part of the clinic is get them on a life-saving medication and then monitor them throughout and then keep them on that life-saving medication. And then when it's appropriate, if it's needed, then taper them off. So that's a big part of the job. And then another part of the job is I'm a consultant. So I'm a pain management consultant for all specialties. So a primary care physician, an oncologist, a hematologist, a surgeon might reach out and say, you know, this is my case. What are your recommendations in terms of modifying their pain plan? And so in that case, I don't necessarily have direct maybe contact with the patient. In that case, I'm just maybe reviewing their case and maybe supplying here some recommendations that, that I offer you for your cases. So I'll do a little bit of that as well.
So you're the go-to.
One of the go-tos, yeah.
Okay. They trained you up.
And they trained me up. And then they, yes.
All right. Awesome. Yeah. Now, I think I've shared before, but for those who haven't heard this yet, I also worked with pain management, and I actually did it in the prison system. So it was very different there. Overlap of you know, pros and cons, but the pain management in itself can be challenging, especially when you have to break the news to somebody that they cannot go on like this. And
go on like this, stay on that medication.
Yes.
That is a hard conversation to have.
So I'm just curious to know, what are your biggest challenges? And I also want to know what you love, you know, the most about the field, but what are some of the biggest challenges you see in pain medicine right now?
That one is a hard conversation to have, right? So you have a patient who has been on opioids and perhaps high dose opioids for 10, 15 years. And maybe they're on a combination that now we would consider to be potentially pretty dangerous. So maybe they're also on a sleep medication or maybe a benzodiazepine as well with that high dose opioid. And they've been on it for quite a while. Someone back in the day put it on them. And so then I have to come and have a conversation if I know that this is a drug combination, a medication combination that you've been on for a while. But for this reason or this reason, we are going to have to modify this medication because you taking these two medications together is potentially very dangerous and fatal. So that is probably one of the challenges, having that conversation and explaining to a patient why being on opioids long term can be harmful and for everyone not appropriate. So that's hard. As I would also say, maybe the second thing is when I'm in the clinic where we do addiction and pain, you know, I'll have to remind sometimes myself, my colleagues, that a patient coming in with an opioid use disorder, they might present in a way that might be, they might be aggressive. They oftentimes are not going to be excited about making changes. Mm-hmm. And I will remind myself and my colleagues that this is a mental illness. Mm-hmm. And so the response to maybe the aggression that we might get from the patient has to be met with the with the mindset that mm-hmm. What I'm dealing with is a mental illness.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to take getting cussed out personally. In every office that I have, I joke about this. I keep a little container of chocolate so that if I have to have a conversation and a patient gets a little aggressive and I get upset, then I might have to retreat after that conversation, and I'll be like, you know what, Jasmine, you burned this little piece of chocolate today.
The chocolate's for you. I thought it was for the patient.
No, it's for me. It's for me because
I thought it was like, here's some dopamine.
Oh, no.
Before I share this news with you.
No, it's for me. It's for me because of how calm funny. I've remained.
Okay. You're replenishing your dopamine.
Yes, that's what it is.
Okay. Right? That's hilarious.
I'm like, okay, you remain calm. So it's but I think the sometimes it's hard to have those conversations.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, they are always rewarding, especially when we get the patients on a more appropriate treatment plan.
Have you ever, I'm only asking this because I've experienced it. Have you ever experienced pushback from providers with the choices?
Yeah. Because some of my providers don't like the conflict of having to then deal with a patient who doesn't want to come off of that Xanax and that mm-hmm. high dose opioids. They have been on it for a while and they don't want to, maybe they don't have the time and they don't want to have to deal with all of the anger and the complaints mm-hmm. that will likely come from adjusting that patient's drug regimen. So that is also something that sometimes we deal with mm-hmm. where the provider is, they never say to me, it's safe to keep them on.
They never disagree with that.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's just the, getting them to put pen to paper as it relates to, we're all on the same page with the fact that this change is, necessary when this drug combination is inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say, just for fair balance, there are cases where, like maybe in the palliative care space, where we might see drug combinations that we feel are appropriate in that case. So mm-hmm. I should say that too for whoever's listening. But when I don't work in that space. So where I work is an outpatient pain management clinic mm-hmm. Where if we're talking about maybe lower back pain or knee pain or something like that, in most cases, what we will say is that these drug combinations are going to be a lot more dangerous because the risks in some of these cases are going to outweigh the benefits. So that's always the approach we take there. Yeah.
Yes. And another big thing that we have to address, especially when we're talking about pain management, and then also in the DMV, there's a lot of folks of color, right?
Yeah.
Is bias.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bias with prescribing people of color opioids when they truly need them.
Yeah.
Bias of assuming people have dependencies or they're trying to get over on the system.
Yeah. The stigma. It's a real thing.
On
both sides. So I see that I'm... I will say, because a lot of my, a decent amount of my patients have sickle cell. So that's another thing that is going to be more prevalent in certain areas than others. And so in this area in Maryland, especially my patients who were pediatric patients and now they've come over to the adult medicine space, there's a lot of different hospitals in this area where their protocol for treating pain on the pediatric side for sickle cell is more liberal. And so by the time they become adults, their brain has been exposed to some high dose opioids, some of them, for quite a while, right? And so we might see them come to the emergency room, our urgent care, and requesting medications by name. And you go to the urgent care and you start to specifically ask for some IV Dilaudid. you're going to get labeled pretty quickly in a lot of places. So I will have patients come back and share with me stories about how that made them feel. How unfair that they feel about maybe the treatment that they may or may not have been given. So it is something that we have to talk through often. I'll have other patients tell me that they feel like we're not adequately treating their pain because of their race. So if they were white, they probably would be able to get more stronger pain medications in some cases. And so one thing I will say is that we do know that the way in which maybe one particular patient might show up and how they're treated is it might be different from another patient, and there is some racial bias that is built into the medical system. So that we know that's in literature something that is pretty proven. But I have to then also address that too, because when I'm talking about tapering down a patient off of opioids because it's inappropriately given, sometimes that's what they'll come and tell me. Well, you're trying to take my meds away from me because I'm black. And that's when a lot of the education has to happen, because I then have to spend, and it's worth the time that we spend explaining that I could believe that your pain is very severe, but also understand that keeping you on this medication, it's also not the appropriate step. So what I'm never saying is that we are unwilling to and don't have an interest in making sure that you are functional and reducing your pain. But we have to come up with a safer pain plan. So that's a lot of the conversations that I have. And we sometimes have to address the fact that they have some preconceived notions that perhaps maybe we're withholding medications, and maybe it's because we're being biased towards them. So it is part of the conversation. I'll see some of my white colleagues have to have that conversation too, and sometimes the way they tiptoe around it sometimes is interesting, I think, sometimes as well. But it definitely comes up, and I think that where it concerns me is when it's appropriate, because I've been doing a lot of giving opioids inappropriately. Where I'm more concerned is when it would be appropriate to give opioids for a pain diagnosis generator that would warrant, for example, cancer, right? So this is one where most people who work in pain management appreciate the fact that for cancer-related pain, the literature, the guidelines are all very clear about this being an appropriate use of opioids. And so there's times where I will see maybe titrations not happening like I believe they should for certain patients. So that's the case where I definitely where I'm able to intervene and then send recommendations back to make sure that appropriate coverage of a patient's pain is considered in those cases.
Yeah, and I feel like I have to acknowledge how important it is for representation, because you having that conversation with a fellow black woman or a fellow black man, it can be received very differently than if a non-black person had that same exact conversation
I see that too.
with them. And it can make a world of a difference just seeing a provider who looks like you, who sounds like you. There's just a level of a trust established, because there is an immediate assumption that you have a shared experience to some capacity. I may not even have to tell you why I feel this way, because you know it from those same shared experiences. And I don't care what their color is, or what their, I just want everyone to know that you are needed. White, black, Hispanic, Asian, you are needed, because there are people who don't want to listen to what doctors are saying, because they have this belief and mindset that they don't know what they're talking about. They wouldn't have heard me. They wouldn't withhold from me. And while there's factual, like historical, we can't just disregard and say that that's not true because it comes from a very real place. But it's, I don't believe it's happening most of the time. And it actually becomes a hindrance to patient care. So I just, I want everybody to get on out there. Go disperse.
Well, because it gets back to what we were talking about building that rapport, that relationship, right? So if I have to, you as a patient have to believe that I have your best interest at heart. I have to, we have to have a connection. You have to believe that I care about you and the care that's being delivered to you for you to then trust whatever care plan I come up with. So I have to start there with all the things. So sometimes that being the foundation of the conversation is what allow for the buy-in that's needed. Because obviously the patients are not taking medications in my presence all the time. So it's the foundation for me for where I have to start for all my cases.
Yes, you have to have the combination of knowing what to say and how to say it. But then you have the element of you who you are and who you present as, and that just adds another element of connection unconsciously with the patients. Go representation.
We love it.
All right, so you've dropped a lot of things along the way about what you love, but just so we have it on record, what is your favorite thing about this specialty?
Oh, man. My favorite thing about, well, so I feel like I've combined two different specialties into this niche. Man, I think that the, how rewarding it feels to know that there is a group of patients that oftentimes are discriminated against, or maybe some providers might pull back from caring for, and to know that we specialize in this group. Because we know that we actually have options for them, and we want to expand access to some of these options. So I think that's becoming one of my favorite things about this niche that we have in this particular clinic, that we've created a home for patients who maybe felt like they did not have a home within the healthcare system. So if you're if you're a pain management, if you're a pain patient, then you're referred to pain management. That's clear to most. If you have some addiction, so some kind of use disorder, then you're referred to chemical dependency or addiction medicine. That's clear to most. But if you're a patient who lives in the gray and you have both, then where do you go? And who wants to care for you? And how comfortable are those providers with caring for these more complex cases? So I think that's my favorite thing, that we've created a home for these patients. We don't shy away. You know, we'll have a patient that will come in and talk about their struggles, about maybe continuing to stay away from whatever that substance, whatever that drug of choice is. But they are a patient who maybe previously used whatever substance, but they today have metastatic cancer. And so please don't turn me away, is what the patient's saying, because someone has to care for me now in this presence. And so then to hear the doctor that I work with speak to that patient with such a level of compassion and also openness, you know, just be honest with us. You know, we're obviously, because we have to do certain opioid stewardship practices. So that's going to require and include things like urine drug screens and things like that. So we're going to know what's going on.
Right.
So just be honest with us. Share with us what's going on.
It's better you tell us than we find
us.
Out.
don't have me, you know, go back to the chart and look at the labs and then be surprised. Just include me in with what's happening so that we can, if we need to, adjust the plan. Because whatever we're doing, it's not going to be punitive. We're not punishing you. We're just trying to keep you safe. And we're trying to do that while still managing your pain. So it's easier to come up with a plan if we have all the information. So that's probably one of my favorite things about. I mean, it's obviously very challenging because of all of the, because of the high level of complexity and concern with all the things that we have absolutely no control over, right? So their housing instability, if that is actually a thing, or what's happening with whatever trauma they might be experiencing as well, or in their home life. Those are all things that are going to impact how well maybe whatever treatment plan we put together. Because as I said, the site component, we can't ignore the fact that that's a very important part of their treatment plan when we think about how can we help them manage their pain. So complexity for sure, but rewarding without question.
It sounds like you feel fulfilled. I'm hearing that. I'm feeling that from you. So it was the right choice.
Yeah, there are so many things that came together that I cannot take credit for that on a regular basis reaffirm that this was where I was supposed to be. Yes. So.
See guys, this is why you take that chance.
Right. So that was, it's all been worth it. It's, yeah.
That's amazing. Do you have any final words before we close today of anything that I failed to ask that you think they would benefit from? Any advice or something you want to leave with them for something to consider?
Maybe just the importance, and I probably have touched on this a little bit, but I'll just highlight this again, the importance of mentorship with whatever path you take. I will be very clear about the fact that when I was in industry, I had supervisors and other mentors who guided me through, and a lot of my success was based on their desire to ensure that I had the resources I needed and could rely on them if I had any missteps or needed some guidance. And then when I was transitioning through and then changed careers to become a pharmacist, I had people who were available to ask questions to and guide me during that transition. And for sure, in pharmacy school, I've mentioned my three iHeart teachers earlier, trailblazers and amazing women in the profession who mentored me in school. And then in residency, still, same thing with my preceptors, amazing preceptors who I still joke with now about how one of my preceptors from my PGY1 year, I call him OG. He's my OG preceptor is what I say. And so so I still will sometimes to this day reach out and say, can I run some things by you? My fellowship director has been super, super supportive and an amazing teacher to learn from during this past year. So no matter where you are in your journey, seek out mentorship. And if you are putting forth 100% effort, you will find someone who is more than willing to partner with you in your journey to continue to train up or learn or adjust. So I would leave you with that. And also the fact that pharmacy is a profession that requires continuing education. There is not a I've arrived moment in my career. I acknowledge that I will continue to be learning as maybe the way that we use certain medications change and what we learn about how to use medications might be adjusted over time. So it's always this attitude of continued learning.
You made the point that it's going to be an exchange with a mentor. And the comment you made was as if like you have to show up. And be that good mentee. Because if you're going to ask someone to pour into you and to spend time with you and to invest into you, you have to show them that it's worth that time.
Yes.
So they have a responsibility to show that you have to show them that I am worth putting this time into.
Yes. I'm that way as a preceptor now. So I precept students, I precept residents, and I will most of the time get students and residents who are prepared, and I send them the information to make sure they're prepared. I ask them to review whatever needs to be reviewed, guidelines, whatever, so that they can come in ready for this experience. Because they're not coming in just to shadow. They're coming in to participate in the day. So there's going to have to be some exchange of ideas. I want them to think through clinically why we're doing what we're doing and how maybe they would approach a situation. And so when I see someone who comes in with a level of preparation that I expect, to be honest, then I am excited, and I am more likely to then take additional time to continue to pour into them. So it's not uncommon that I would stay late or continue working on something with a resident or a student because I sincerely enjoy teaching. And also I see the level of preparation they came in with and how hungry they are and how excited they are. So that, so I'm excited for them, and I will continue to, because obviously my day is pretty full. And so taking on something extra, then it's going to require more time. And so I'm happy to do it when I see that you're taking this seriously. There's been rare times, but it has happened, where it became clear to me that someone came on board and did not prepare. It was not committed or taking it very seriously, or their level of professionalism was not where I thought it should be. And that's very concerning to me, but I joke sort of all the time that like I have a job, right? And so I've done what I needed to do to get to where I'm at. I need you to be taking this way more seriously because you don't have a job yet. So, I think that the showing up and preparing as a learner, no matter what phase you are in your learning process, I believe that it was because my fellowship director could see how passionate I was about continuing to develop and be determined in my learning, that then he, someone who had two plates full, decided to then take me under his wing as his fellow. He did not need any more work to do. But he decided that he thought it was worth his investment. And I believe it's because of how committed I was to learning that he took that interest. And that is what also I do with my learners.
And you said that you told them to seek out mentors. Now, for their clarification, are you speaking to identifying somebody who is in a place that you want to be, who has the attributes? Because you can have mentors for different things, right? Seeking them out and directly going to them and saying, hey, I want to grow in this area. Do you mind spending some time with me here or there, teaching me how I can go? Or did a lot of your mentorships develop organically? And then there was a mutual understanding that this is what it is?
Probably a mix. I will tell you that when I decided that University of Maryland School of Pharmacy was where I was going, I made that decision during open house. And I made that decision when Dr. Chanel Whitaker was one of the people on faculty. So part of the open house was faculty being on a panel and then speaking to the some of the attributes of the school. And so I saw her from the crowd there before I became a student, and saw that I just something about her passion and specifically then her specialty, I just gravitated towards. And then I took an opportunity when I saw her after the open house, she was standing around kind of greeting the people, the potential candidates. I definitely went up to her and introduced myself. I made myself known before even getting accepted.
I remember that. That's just you as a person, though.
I don't even know if she remembers this conversation, but I for sure remember this conversation. I introduced myself to her then. And then when I got in, and because I don't know that she taught some of the first P1 or P2. I don't know that she taught some of the first years, but then I finally got into some courses where she was now teaching some of the classes. And then again, had to make myself known because I saw a mentor for myself, and I was thankful that she allowed me to be mentored by her. But I think but I would agree that it could happen in both ways, and I think for me it has happened in both ways where some mentee mentor relationships developed pretty naturally, and then others I think I sought them out and I realized that there was something about their success and maybe their passion and how they moved, and I could learn from them. And so being in their aura, being in their presence would be beneficial to me. And so I wanted to make that happen. So.
Wise words. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
This has been wonderful. Through your story, we've covered a lot. Like taking that leap of faith. Taking that chance and then going all in on it, not halfway, but like committing and going the long haul, continual education.
Oh, yes.
Because what I have found, I've only been practicing for 4 years. The ones who are practicing what I would call borderline dangerously are the ones where they stopped learning. So continual education, speaking up. And expressing what you want.
Yeah.
And the worst people can say is no.
Right. I mean, they can come back and say no. Yeah. And then you've lost nothing.
And then also, you were prepared. Like you saw what you wanted. You did research. You investigated. And then you sought counsel from wise, trusted wise people who could give you good feedback.
Yeah.
And then we learned a lot about pain management and what that looks like and you know, addiction medicine. So we've learned so much in this hour. I really do appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah.
So I think we're going to close on that.
Okay.
And
thanks guys. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Bye everyone.
Bye.